Let's turn our attention now to our study of Acts chapter 27. The questions, we're going to complete those and get into the 28th chapter. At least that's my intent in our study this morning. We have set up here to go through the questions. And as always, we use these questions simply as a review of the things that we have already discussed. So unless you have a question about the questions, we will go through these rather quickly and just check your understanding and your answers to them. What I like to do, as you have noted throughout this study, is to summarize just in one brief statement the things that are in the paragraphs of the chapter. So in chapter 27, verses 1 through 8, we talked about that, and we noted in those verses last time. What did we find in that paragraph, Lynn?
That Paul started his travel to Rome. He went from Caesarea and up the side. They went around the coast of Asia, and they ended up in their haven on the side of Crete.
All right, exactly. And as we continue in that portion, in the next section, verses 9 through 26, a rather lengthy portion. What's there? Randy, Charles, 9 through 26. So basically, yes, the shipwreck. Things are looking very grim at this particular point. The winds come up and things are about to fall apart. We know that Paul sees an angel of the Lord, and he said he believed that what the angel told him, that it would be so, that there would be no loss of life. Verse 27 through the end of the chapter, 27 through 44. What's in those verses, Denise?
They were shipwrecked. 27. For 14 days they hadn't eaten, I think.
Right, they had not eaten.
And so they were shipwrecked on land.
All right, this tells us of the breaking apart of the ship and how that they make their way to the shore. Those that could swim went first, and then some on planks and parts of the ship, they all escaped safely to the land. Now, to identify the people in this chapter, we need to be very familiar with who this man is, because he's a prominent player in the chapter. Who's Julius? Donna?
He's a centurion of the
Roman
band, and he took care of the prisoners.
All right, he's a centurion. So here's a soldier, and it's his job to securely deliver the prisoners on their voyage to Rome. Adramidium, what can you tell me about that? And I probably have that labeled wrong. I have it under the people embarking in a ship of Adramidium. Can somebody tell me about that while I have it on the board? Adramidium is not necessarily a person's name.
No, it's an ancient city of Mysia.
All right.
And the first ship that Paul was on, that's where it was headed, which is why when they stopped at Myra, they changed ships.
All right, exactly right. And I appreciate you getting that there. I don't know why I had it in that place. Aristarchus, very important character. Tell me about Aristarchus. Randy Bowles.
He is a companion of Paul, has been for years.
Yes, traveled extensively with Paul all the way back. We were introduced, I think, to him in Acts chapter 19 in Ephesus. Alexandria. I've got that in the wrong place, too. Why do I have that there? This ship from a ship of Alexandria. Tell me about why that's so important to the chapter.
That was one of the they changed ships because the ship they were on was going to the north.
Yeah.
And Alex, the ship that they picked up was going to Italy.
All right.
They needed to go.
All right. Alexandria is not a people, it's a place. And I don't know why I have that in that section. I have to change that. But, pardon me? There were people there. Well, that's true. That is true. But Alexandria was located where? In Egypt, that's right. And of course, it was a major shipping vessel carrying wheat to Italy. And so I see if we have it on the places list. Sidon. In Sidon, Julius was very friendly to Paul, even though he was a centurion in charge of Paul's security as a prisoner. When they arrived at Sidon, he allowed him the privilege to go ashore and to refresh himself with his friends. Now, that tells us somewhat of the reputation Paul had thus far, at least, in this journey to Rome and as a prisoner. The Lee of Cyprus becomes very important to us. You remember our map. We talked about that rather extensively. Lisa, what can you tell me about the Lee of Cyprus? Why did they travel there? The significant word, I think, here is, you know, we can locate the island of Cyprus, but the significant word is they traveled on the lee side of Cyprus. Pardon me?
For shelter.
Yes, for shelter, yes. When you're traveling on the leeward side of an island or even of a land mass as such, the purpose is to protect yourself from the wind.
New American Standard says under the shelter of Cyprus.
Under the shelter, that's right. And Myra, what's its significance to this chapter? You mentioned that a moment ago, Lynn. What was it? That's where they changed ships. All right, very good. And then Sinaitis, what happened there? Sinaitis. Yes, yes, things are not going so well by the time they get to Sinaitis. And then the Lee of Crete, another island. We've got a similar circumstance that's taking place. They travel under the Lee of Crete. And what was there?
Fair Havens.
Fair Havens, that's right. And so they anchor there at that port, but it was their desire to go on to a place called Phoenix. Why was Phoenix more desirable? And how far away from Fair Havens was it? Yes, it was more suitable, and do we know why?
It's the face of the southwest.
Yes, it provided greater protection from the tempestuous winds during this time of year, which, by the way, was what time of year?
Winter
months, yes. It began in October, late September, October, and traveled on through the winter season. Now, Phoenix was how far from Fair Havens? That's significant when we're accounting for the travel.
About
40-45 miles. Now, you'd think that traveling by ship, if the weather is fair and the winds are suitable, that it wouldn't take long to travel such a distance. But the problem was the wind shifted. Now, here in the desert, we sometimes think that the winds are always out of the west. And you can look at the trees and see that the trees lean toward the east. And so you could come to the conclusion that our winds are always out of the west. But is it true that they are always out of the west? No, it is not true. It is not true. And I'll just hasten to tell you that several years ago we had a burn day down here at the building. During the winter season, and we had the burn permit and all of that, and the winds were out at the west, and so it was carrying the wind away from the school. But the wind shifted, and then we got in trouble because somebody called the fire department, and the wind shifted, and the smoke then was going over in the direction of the school. Well, there wasn't much that we could do about that, and so that's just the way that it was. We had to kind of get by and endure that time. But we are familiar with the changing of winds, and if you are familiar with this portion of the world, they can change rather rapidly. Cauda, what can you tell me about Cauda?
It's an island.
All right, another island, a small island, and they were hoping that they might be able to find some protection there, but that was not big enough to do them a whole lot of good. It says they were able, with difficulty, to secure the boat in Cauda. Now, what boat were we talking about?
The small boat.
Right, kind of like a lifeboat. Now, my understanding is that during that time, they would have a small boat that they would just simply tow along behind the ship. Well, when the winds came and the sea became tempestuous, that lifeboat wasn't much of a lifeboat if it was being beaten up by the waves of the sea. So they would secure it. They would lift it. And some of you who've been down to see the Queen Mary or other various vessels that have lifeboats, you know that they're up on racks and they're designed so that during the time of need they can be lowered down into the water. And that's what they were doing, trying to secure the boat. Now, they got that done, but then they're concerned about Syrtis. Tell me about this place. On the north end of Africa, there was a, still is, a shallow, a sandbar, as it were. And the problem with that was, if you have a ship that has cargo in it, you're going to be sitting deep into the water. And if you run onto that sandbar with a load of wheat or any other load of cargo, what's going to happen to your ship if the storm hits? It'll tear it all to pieces. Yeah, you couldn't get it off the sandbar. And so they were concerned about Sirtis. And it tells us they lowered the gear and were so driven. Now, when we talked about lowering the gear, we noted that most commentators identify a couple of things that they did here that are possibilities. One is they lowered the sail so that the wind would not catch the sail. Others suggest that perhaps they lowered a floating anchor to simply so slow the ship down so it wouldn't drift quite so badly. And so that's the significance of this place. Andrea, what can you tell me about, or Adria, what can you tell me about Adria?
That's where they were tossed to and fro, and that's where the shipwreck was.
All right, they were tossed to and fro, and they began to throw out the tackling of the ship, the furniture of the ship, anything that wasn't tied down, so to speak. And now we've got the being on the sea during the storm for 14 days. And the sailors begin to think, well, we're about to reach land. How did they determine they were about to reach land? Did they just get a feeling we're getting close? All right, they began to measure. Now, we talked about that in our study last week, how that when they would begin to reach land, even during the time of storms, they could hear the breaking of the waves, and they would lower and measure. Go ahead.
You spend several years on the water, you begin to get a feel for these kind of things when you're approaching land and when you're out in open sea. Furthermore, when they're talking about taking the soundings, they may not have done this in this case. I know that sometimes when they took soundings, they would take samples of the soil down below. Sometimes it's just a dead weight, and they measure the depth of water.
Right.
Sometimes they'll take a sample of the soil and bring it up, and based on whether it's mostly sand, that means they're getting really close to land, or if it's just mud, then they could be much further away.
Right. Well, here we learn that they did sound, and they found that they were 20 fathoms, and then a little while later they sounded and found that they were 15 fathoms. Now, we did the conversions of that and noted that the first sounding, they noticed that they were about 120 feet deep, and then later they were about 90 feet deep. So what's that telling them? You're getting shallower and shallower and shallower, and so this ship is approaching land. And the question was, are we approaching something, as you said, that has a soft bottom, or are we approaching a coral reef, or are we approaching the rocks? And so these are concerns that the sailors obviously would have during the time of this tempestuous storm. Now, some of the questions that we want to look at, well, one of the points that we want to make at this particular paragraph is that they've been 14 days during this storm when they've neither seen the sun nor the stars. Now, how do you navigate on a ship? By the stars. That's right. You've got to be able to see something that gives you some position. And so they didn't know where they were. Not being able to see the sun, the moon, or the stars for 14 days, and then to suppose, well, we are approaching something, and so we need to find out from this, what is it that we're approaching. Now, question from the text. Who was likely with Paul as they sailed for Italy? Julius was, yes, but he was the chief captain, or the centurion, as the soldier. Who else do we know that was likely with Paul? Luke was, and we know that Luke, as you mentioned a few moments ago about Aristarchus, that Luke traveled with Paul on and off for a long, long time. And so his being with Paul was on the plus side. Paul has had some horrible times during this time. Luke, being a physician, it would be great to have your own doctor along.
I'd like just to take a note here that with Luke's recording of not just this chapter, but this is really true throughout the book of Luke, or book of Acts, as well as Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Scholars are pretty certain that Luke and Acts were at one point one document, and that with appropriate text they got separated. And you go back to the beginning of Luke, and Luke says, "I'm writing down with meticulous care, basically, everything that has happened here." This chapter in particular is full of detail.
Yes.
A tremendous amount of detail. And yet people want to maintain that the Bible, especially Acts, is nothing but myth and fable. When you sit down to write myth and fable, you don't include details.
Right.
Because there's something that can be checked factually. And what we find here, not only are details of an eyewitness observer, but we find details that are factually correct. He has the nautical terms down.
Oh, yes.
Very, very well.
Yes.
And it is very likely that this is exactly what happened.
Well, yes. In the writing of the book of Acts, we know that, of course, Luke is the author. It begins in the same way that the Gospel of Luke begins, addressed to Theophilus, as the Gospel of Luke is. We know that the Gospel of Luke begins, and I would suggest that if you're trying to study the events of the life of Christ in some kind of chronological order, read the Gospel of Luke as opposed to Matthew, Mark, and John, because they do have different purposes. The writing of the Gospel of Luke, he tells us, is written so that you might know the order. That word is used in the initial verses of the Gospel of Luke. And one of the things that you will note here is the things that he is writing about is so that these who would read this would know the accuracy of the history of the things that took place. And you see that revealed in the first few verses of the book of Acts.
And we need to, instead of allowing people to glibly throw out these accusations about the Bible being history, or not history, but myth and fable and just something made up, I think that we need to instead be able to stand up and defend this Bible and be able to say, oh no, instead of it being once upon a time, instead it's very detailed and it has all kinds of points you can look for that make, and every time they're shown to be historically correct.
Well, that's right. And of course, we've made this point in our study of the book, that when you find terms that Luke uses that so-and-so went up to a certain place, when you look at the topography of the land, that's exactly what took place. When so-and-so went down to a certain place, the topography of the land was he went lower in elevation. Now, if you're writing a book just because, and you're not writing by inspiration, the source is purely man, you would not expect to find 100% accuracy on that note in and of itself. When you start to talk about the distances from point A to point B, the historian is exactly accurate regarding those things. And then when you start to talk, we talked about this last time, when you discuss the location of Phoenix, scholars have come along later and said, no, Phoenix is not located where we always thought that it was, because the direction of the harbor that's described by Luke, it's not that way. And now scholars have come along and said, well, now we know that there's been evidence of great earthquake in that area that has rearranged the topography from modern day to what it was when Luke was writing. So Luke's presentation of it is, again, found to be accurate. And so we want to note that. And this is all valuable information. The book of Acts in particular is the only book of New Testament history that we have. So understanding that it is an inspired history is crucial. It's just absolutely crucial. The accuracy of it is just absolutely crucial. And when you begin, as you said, to talk about the nautical terms that are used and the dangers that these soldiers recognized, and that Paul, having traveled the Mediterranean Sea numerous times, and we made this point last time, this is not the first shipwreck he's been in on the Mediterranean Sea. And so these are all historical facts that are consistent with even modern day travel on the Mediterranean Sea. Valid point. We've got to note that. Almost got me started. What was the course they planned to sail in the ship of Adramidian? What was the course that they planned to sail? Where are they going? All right, they're aiming to go to Asia. That's where this ship is supposedly pointed. But we found that when they came to Myra, they found a ship that was going directly to Italy. At least that was the plan. Now, if you wanted to go to Italy, Bruce, you'd probably just get on the computer and chart an airplane to Italy. And you'd say it goes from here to here to here to here. That wasn't how you traveled during New Testament times. You travel on a cargo ship, and the probability of finding a schedule, it would be difficult. Especially during this time of year, because it was very uncertain traveling during this time of year. Sometimes it was necessary for a ship to winter, as we see here in this chapter, in a certain place, or try to get to another place to winter because it was better. And to think of travel, you're going to have to spend months to get from point A to point B. And so travel during these times was not something that was really easy. And I think there's a valid reason for us to consider that most folks did not travel far from home for that very reason. Now, we could talk about another application of that, but that's beyond the scope of our study here, regarding the Nile River. Had that discussion this week, so why that's on my mind. Where did they arrive the next day? They got on this ship of Adramidian, and where did they arrive the next day? I'm sorry? One more time. Sidon, yes. I heard Titus. No. You've been looking at my list. All right, they came to Sidon. And what did Paul, was he allowed to do?
Go to friends
and refresh himself, which tells us he had a good relationship. Why did the ship sail under the lee of Cyprus, Richard? You're a sailor today, so why did he sail under the lee of Cyprus?
Protection from the winds.
Protection from the wind. We know about that, or you do. What did the centurion find in Myra?
Another ship
going the way he wants to go. So you've got to keep your head up on a swivel to find out who's going where so that you can reach your destination. What does this say about the ease of travel during the days of the Roman Empire? There were many ships, yes. Now that calls to mind a passage that we need to be aware of. You recall in Galatians chapter 4 and in verse 4, it tells us that in the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, that He might redeem them that are under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. That expression, in the fullness of times, boy, that's so important. Because it tells us that at a select time, God sent forth His Son. When we look back into the Old Testament scriptures in the book of Daniel in chapter 2, you're all familiar with this Old Testament chapter. We know that Daniel is telling King Nebuchadnezzar some things that would come to pass in the last days. You remember the vision that the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had of this image that had a head of gold and a chest and arms of silver and a belly and thighs of brass and then legs of iron and feet, part of iron and part of clay. And he saw that image till a small stone was cut out of the mountain and smote the image on the feet and destroyed it. And Daniel is telling King Nebuchadnezzar in the days of these kings, that is, as he identifies this image to represent world empires, in the days of these kings, God's going to do something. Why didn't God do it during the Babylonian kingdom? Time wasn't right. Why didn't He do it during the days of
Alexander the Great.
The time wasn't right. But the fourth empire, we know, was the Roman Empire. And strangely enough, when you begin to read in your New Testament, who are the kings?
Caesar.
The Caesars, the Roman Caesars. And so we have this fourth world empire in place. It is not by accident that during the days of these kings, God would set up a kingdom which could never be destroyed, nor the sovereignty thereof be left to another people. But it would break in pieces all these and stand forever. Such a powerful Old Testament text. But yet we find that these are the things that are coming to pass when God sent forth His Son, born under the law, born of a woman. This was identified as the fullness of times. I want to suggest to you, in reference to this particular question, what does this say about the ease of travel during the days of the Roman Empire? Well, we've learned that there were many ships. That's true. And they traveled the Mediterranean Sea. My understanding is that it was the desire of the Roman Empire, as well as previous empires, to control approximately 200 miles inward from the Mediterranean Sea. That would constitute their empire. Now, why?
Trade value.
That's right. All these ships going from Egypt to Rome and all kinds of places around the Mediterranean Sea. If we control all of that, we've got the income from all the commerce of the known world. So when you look at the Babylonian Empire, were they aware of that? Well, yes. What about Alexander? Yes. And what about the Roman Caesars? Yes. And so they realize if we can conquer and hold all of that, it'll make our empire rich. And so that's what we've got. Now, during the days of the Roman Empire, in order to maintain that control, what did the Romans have to have?
Soldiers.
That's right. We've got to have a strong army. Now, if you're going to have a strong army, in order to defend that much territory, you're going to have to be able to move soldiers from here to here to here to here. And you can do that on ships. And you can also do that on roads. And thus the expression, all roads lead to Rome. And that's the way that it was during the Roman Empire, which made travel. See, soldiers were not the only ones that used those roads. It made travel by means of ship and travel by means of roads easier than it had ever been in history. You think God didn't know that when He selected this time in the fullness of time to send forth His Son? Now, why was travel so significant to that time that God had selected? What was it the gospel was supposed to do?
Go into all the world.
In order for the gospel to go into all the world, you have to be able to travel. And here we have a unique circumstance in history that had never existed before. The ease of travel. God sent forth His Son during that time. The fullness of time. When time was just right, that's when Jesus came. Letter B of that particular question, I think I answered it. Why was this so important? He found this ship going to Rome. That's where He wants to go. And it made travel to that destination fairly easy, shouldn't it?
To sort of sum up, the nature of the Roman Empire was such that transportation, communication was made much easier, which meant the spread of the gospel was much more enabled.
Very simply put. Now, one of the things that we want to know is the commission that the Lord gave unto the apostles was go preach the gospel to every creature. And by the time Paul is in Rome, writing the what we refer to as the prison epistles, and what were they? The prison epistles?
Ephesians.
Colossians.
Philippians.
And Philemon. I'm dragging it out. And Philemon. I know you know this, all right? And so, by the time we read of the writing of the prison epistles, one of those being Colossians, Paul said in Colossians chapter 1, verse 23, that the gospel has been preached to every creature under heaven, whereof I, Paul, was made a minister. And I've read materials, and you have too. Well, we don't know that it was preached in America. We don't know that it was preached in India. We don't know that it was preached throughout Europe or Asia. All I know is what Paul said, and I'll just camp on that. We have the record of the preaching of some of the apostles in the book of Acts. The primary characters are the Apostle Peter and the Apostle Paul. How many apostles were there?
10, 11
more. All right. And so we don't know where they went. We don't have that inspired record of where they went or what they did. We do have some of the epistles of Peter. We have some of the epistles of Paul. But as far as the destination of the other apostles, we don't know where they went. But we do know that without internet, they carried the gospel to every creature, just as Paul recorded.
Very briefly, just say that I have been to a village in Japan that the tradition is there was a guy there, he was a Hebrew that came and settled there. The village songs have several Hebrew words embedded within them.
Somebody's been there, hasn't
they? Yes. Now, I'm not saying he's a Christian, not saying he brought the gospel or anything like that. The point is, even 2,000 years ago, people did get around the world.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the apostles had that commission to do that. So it to suggest that it was not possible is not reality. What time of year was Paul traveling to Rome? Well, we've talked about that. In autumn, that's right. In the autumn, on into the winter, of course, with this shipwreck. Number 9, what did Paul admonish them to do?
Stay put.
Stay put. Now, where did he tell them that? At Fair Havens. That's right. Now, where is it they want to go? They want to go to Phoenix. Bad idea. Paul told them. I told you so. Don't do that. How did the centurion respond to Paul's warning? He didn't listen. Who did he listen to? The shipmaster. That's right. And why did they not stay in the haven of Fair Havens? Well, he listened to the shipmaster rather than to listen to Paul. Where did they go? Where did they want to go for the winter? We identified that, Phoenix. Research why this might be a better port than Fair Haven. Somebody tell me that. We talked about that. Why might it be a better port?
I looked it up. It actually appears to be southwest portion of the island, and the way that the port is laid out, apparently it allows them to stay in port and still put up with the winds that might come down without damaging them.
Okay. Now, from my understanding, the way it's described here, no longer is it that way, but at that time kind of had peninsulas that went out that created somewhat of a harbor that would protect if you came in from the north or protect you if you came in from a south direction. So, yes, this would make it better, and I would dare say that because ships found it better as far as the weather to abide there during the winter, there were likely better provisions, amenities there for such purposes. But be that as it may, why did they sail along Crete? We've answered that as we talked about the lee. Why did they sail along Crete? Protect them from the wind. Number 14, what is the name of the tempestuous wind and how did it affect their travels? Anybody dare to try to pronounce it?
You're right, well,
that works for me. Number 15, where did they go and what did they do to secure the ship?
They went wherever the wind wanted
them. Well, that's what they did, yes. But how did they secure the ship?
They put the
cables around it. And I understand that that's something that was commonplace. They carried provisions for that. A wooden ship would break apart, so they tied it together.
And you wouldn't have them there all the time because otherwise it would cause increased drag on the ship. And so the smoothness of the hull would be affected by the cables around the thing.
Well, yes, that's true. And, of course, I'm guessing that the cables would have some weight. That many cables to secure a ship of that size it would cause there's a word for that, but it would sink down deeper into the ocean with all the weight. You're going to help me with that word? Or
the draft.
I guess. I don't know the words. Anyway, number 16. What was done the second day of the storm and the third day? What are they doing? That's right. They're lightening the ship because things don't look good. Question? 17? As all appeared to be lost, what did Paul tell them? What have they not been doing? They've not been eating. And why might you not want to eat, Richard?
You wouldn't feel all that good with the test you received.
All right, you might be hanging over the side up, Chucky. So that's likely so. And how long have they gone in this condition? 14 days. Now, if you're facing something that's going to be quite dramatic, you're going to be shipwrecked, which means you're going to have to work really hard just to save your life. We know that Paul has told them something. First of all, what has Paul told them besides to eat?
That the angel of the night told them that they were going to be saved.
All right, an angel of the Lord stood beside me in the night and told me that there's not going to be any loss of life. And I believe God whose I am. I want us to note that. Paul said, I believe what God has told me. Now, we asked the question and answered it in our last study. Why did Paul have any reason to believe what the angel told him? Well, this is not the first time that God has told him something like that that has proven to be the case. Number 19, describe how they knew they were nearing land. We talked about that as we looked at the last few verses of the chapter. How did they know they were nearing land? Randy Bowles?
Well, first of all, I suspect they could hear.
Yes.
The sound of the storm changed a bit, but they also took soundings.
All right. Number 20, what did they do to prevent them from being cast ashore on rocky ground? We didn't talk about that today.
They put the sail up so that they could use the wind to their advantage. They also loosed the bands on the rudder, which meant that they could now steer the rudder.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they chose poorly and ended up on sand bar anyway.
Okay. All right. All right, they did. They put some anchors down and in the night and wait for day. And what they're, as I understand this, what they're trying to do is to steer the ship onto the beach of this island.
Now, I'll point out again, the anchors that they cast out are not heavy iron anchors or something that hold to the ground, but they're what's called sea anchors. And they throw them out, and they're in the shape of a cone, and they grab the water because they're open in the front and closed in the back, and that keeps them in the proper direction. So later on, you see the sailor for putting the boat down so that supposedly they could let sea anchors out from the fore part of the ship.
All right.
And that's when they cut the boat away.
All right. And what is it they don't want to happen? The reason we're seeing them do this, they don't want the ship to be hit by the waves broadside. Okay? That would tear the ship apart. Now, when they run the front of the ship onto the shore, the back end is still out in the waves. And we've noted that it's where two seas came together. Now, what would you expect to find at the back end of the ship?
Moving back
and forth. Oh, it's just, yeah, you've got the winds blowing it back and forth and back and forth, and the front now has run ashore. So the front is not going back and forth, and the back is going back and forth. Any of you ever try to break a wire? I did something like that just the other day. You're trying to move it back and forth and back and forth. And what eventually happens? It'll break. What's going to happen to that ship? It's going to break. And that's ultimately what did happen to the ship. What did some do in an effort to escape the ship? Going to let down the lifeboat. And what Paul tell them? All right, don't take the lifeboat, because if you stay with the ship, you'll live, and if you get in the lifeboat, you'll die. And how do they respond to that? All right, they cut the ropes and let her fall. And so goes the life ship boat.
Important to note that the army cut the boat away. The sailors were the ones that were getting ready to leave.
Yes, that is an important note. The soldiers had swords, I would suspect, to be able to expeditiously do that.
I was going to say, pretty much the same thing he just said. In verse 11, it says the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than what was being said by Paul. But by this point, the centurion is pretty well persuaded by Paul.
Yes.
Because he's already seen that.
Yes.
Paul knows what he's talking about.
He knows what he's talking about. So they cut away the lifeboat, and it falls into the sea and is gone. What did they do after they ate?
Threw the rest of it overboard.
Threw it all over, yeah. Number 24, What do they do then in an effort to go ashore?
Threw themselves
over. All right. Those that could swim. I find this interesting. We'll get to that on this question. What happened to the ship? It's destroyed. Number 26, what did the soldiers want to do? What was the response of the centurion?
They wanted to kill
the prisoners. That's right. Now, why did the soldiers want to kill the prisoners?
Well, because it was in their lives.
That's right. Roman soldiers responsible with his own life for a prisoner that escapes. So if the prisoners escape, then the soldiers would be killed. And so their intent was, let's kill all the prisoners. And the centurion said, no, we're not going to do that. Why did he say that?
Wanted to save Paul.
Now, one of the things we've already noted is he has evidently befriended Paul. He sees that Paul is not a hazard. He's been willing to let him go ashore at Sidon and refresh himself with his friends and so forth. He's now listening to Paul. No interest in killing Paul. What did he command to do to escape to safety? This I find interesting.
Well, first he sent the soldiers to swim ashore because then if they were there first, they would prevent any prisoners from escaping.
Well, that's right. That just makes sense. And those that could not swim, they then got on the boards and the planks and they made it then to safety. And that's where chapter 27 does end. Now, that brings us to chapter 28. Well, I'd like for you to read chapter 28, two or three times, if you will, between now and next time, because it is much like chapter 27. It's a narrative of the things that take place, just a description of events as they happen. And so in that chapter, we read about the shipwreck. We read about how they were treated after they got on the island of Malta. And we read about a number of events in that connection. We also want to note when they finally do arrive in Italy, how they are received by the brethren. How they're received by the brethren. When you read in the book of Romans, keep in mind Paul's already written these brethren before he arrives there. I don't think there's any evidence that Paul has ever been in Rome. Who preached the gospel first in Rome? I don't know, but we know there was a church or churches in Rome. At the time Paul writes the book of Romans before he's arrested in Jerusalem, writing it from Corinth. And so, noting those things, the reception that he receives of the brethren in Rome, I think is remarkable. And it helps us to see why in Romans chapter 1, verse 8, he gives thanks for his brethren. Even the brethren he's not even met. Thankful for the brethren. Thank you for your attention.